And sitting with me is Sonia Pressman Fuentes, class of 1950. Sonia, why don't you introduce yourself?
Well, first of all, I pronounce my first name Sonia.
Sonia.
How else can I introduce myself?
There you go. You came to Cornell in?
1946, after I graduated from Monticello High School in Monticello, New York.
And how did you choose Cornell?
Well, I have to think back. What first got me thinking about college was that I took a test for the George Lefevre scholarship, which I won, and then I took a test for New York State scholarship, and I got that too. And somewhere along the line, I applied to Cornell and Hartford College in Oneonta. I don't know what brought me, how I came to know about Cornell, but those are the only two colleges I applied to.
And so you got accepted to Cornell and you chose Cornell. And did you visit Cornell before you came as a freshman?
No, never. I had never been to any college before I came to Cornell as a student.
And what was it like when you came to Cornell in 1946?
Well, it was because I'd never seen a college in my life. I was totally unprepared for the vastness of Cornell. I thought a college based on movies I had seen was a single building. Hmm. And so when my parents drove me here, I was looking for a single building that would be Cornell. And we stopped in a wooded area, and I knocked on the door of a house that turned out to be a fraternity house, and I asked them to let me know where Cornell was, and the gentleman spread his arms wide and said, "This is Cornell." And I was totally taken aback.
Hmm. And you eventually found your way to your freshman residence hall. Where did you live?
I lived in Balch Hall, on the top floor.
And what was that like?
Well, that was wonderful. I loved Balch Hall. And we called that top floor Seventh Heaven. Hmm. And we had a group up there of maybe, I don't know, between 5 and 10 women. It was only women. And we were friends with each other, and I had a wonderful first year. I did not want a roommate that was selected for me. In my subsequent years, I selected a roommate and had roommates. But in the first year, I didn't want somebody to pick a roommate for me. So I had a room for myself and was very friendly with the other women who were on that floor.
Sure. And what was it like being a freshman female at Cornell? What was your experience?
Well,
like?
It wasn't the part that I was a female really didn't play a role in it, but what played a role in it was that I came from a small town in the Catskill Mountains of New York. I was a thoroughly unsophisticated young woman, although I would have been 18 then. And even though I came from a small town, I was even more isolated than that, because my parents had a summer resort, a bungalow colony, 1.25 miles out of town. So I, except for going to school, and I did belong to some extracurricular clubs in high school, but by and large, and I had friends, but I was just totally socially inept. Didn't know how to dress, wore glasses, came my first year with braces, so I never smiled that first year, and I was totally really out of it and unprepared for a university with what seemed to me like sophisticated students who knew how to handle themselves.
And you found your way, and what were the rules for students living in Balch at the time?
Well,
the women.
You couldn't have a man in your room. I mean, nobody, it sounds odd to say that now, but nobody thought of that. Once a year, you could have a man visit your room, and the doors of the rooms had to be open while that man visited your room. And there was a time every night when you had to be in. I don't remember what the time was. It could have been 10 o'clock during the week at midnight. On weekends, I don't remember the hours, but there were hours when you had to be in.
And what did you do for fun when you weren't studying?
Well, you know, I was not a big fun person in those days. I am today. I don't know what Oh, well, we had a lot of, what would you call them, sitting around and talking.
Mm-hmm.
We would talk about all the big issues, bull sessions.
Right.
Bull sessions. I think we spent a lot of time sitting around and talking.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember what else I did other than that for fun. We went out on dates.
Right.
I had an interesting experience. Not an interesting experience, but as I said, I wore glasses. But when I went out on a date, I didn't want to greet my date with glasses. And they were, I think, fairly thick glasses because I was nearsighted and astigmatic. So the date would meet you in the lobby downstairs. And I remember, especially if it was a blind date, and even if it wasn't a blind date, I would go down and walk back and forth looking for my date who was sitting there, but I couldn't recognize him. And then I had the steps memorized from Bulge. They were 18, 17, 11, 10, because I couldn't see them.
Oh my goodness.
So I had the steps, and I never fell or anything like that.
Wow. Wow. And you had a wonderful house parent or house mother.
Well, I wouldn't call her wonderful, but she was a strong woman.
Right.
I don't think she'd ever been married. Her name was Helen Armour. But she once did me a wonderful service. I was in my freshman year, and my parents came to visit. And I had a nice visit with my parents, and they went back to wherever they were staying in the area. And I expected to see them the next day. And the next morning, I hear all these shrieks of women shrieking and screaming. I didn't know what it was, and all of a sudden, my father and mother walk into my room. Men are not allowed there.
Mm.
And my father walks in and says, "Pack your things, we're going home." And I didn't know what was happening. What happened, as I learned later on, was that when my parents left me, Bulge has a very big area in the back, sort of a flat area in the back, where boys and girls, when they left each other on a Saturday night, or Friday night, whatever it was, kissed goodnight there.
Hmm.
And my parents walked out that entrance.
Ha.
And they saw all these men and women kissing and hugging each other. So my father came into Bulge the next morning, and he said to me, "Pack up, this is a whorehouse, and you can't remain here." So I didn't know what to do. I didn't want to end my Cornell stay. And somewhere along the line, because these women were all screaming that there was a man in the dorm, Miss Armour came in.
Ah.
And she heard what was going on, and she had her little private apartment there. And she invited my mother and father and me to tea in there right then. And she spoke to my father, and she said to him, "This is not a whorehouse. It's a respectable place, and those are just young men and women kissing goodnight, and everything's all right." And she turned my father around, and I was able to remain.
Oh my goodness. Wow. One victory. One big victory. And then you subsequently told me that you went on to visit her at one point.
Years later, after she left Cornell, she was in some kind of a residence for senior people in Pennsylvania, and I went to see her.
Oh, that's lovely. Now tell me about your academic study here and what you went through to figure out how you were going to get a degree. And
well, I started, I had studied Latin in high school, and I took a year of French because I was born in Germany and spent some months in Antwerp. I used to think I spoke French there, but my brother thinks that I might have spoken Flemish.
Ah.
But I forgot that. But I took mm-hmm. French, and so I love languages, mm-hmm. and I loved Yiddish and knew Yiddish, and I could understand German. So I thought I would be a language major. And my first major at Cornell was languages, and I thought that I would be an interpreter for the United Nations. I could see myself in this glamorous role. And then I thought about that, and I felt, well, you're not doing that much just interpreting somebody else's words, so I needed to change majors. Well, I've always been interested in relations mm-hmm. among people, so I next majored in psychology, was my second major.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked that very much, but somewhere along the line, somebody said to me, you know, if you want to accomplish something in psychology, you have to have a master's and probably a PhD. Hmm. And I was the first person in my family to go to college. I really didn't plan on going to college because I started school a little later than other people because I came from Europe. So when I graduated from high school, I was 18. Most of my classmates were 17. Mm-hmm. So in the beginning, I had no plan to go to college because I said, if I go to college, I'll be 22 when I graduate. That's too old. Mm-hmm. So it was only other people and teachers that turned me around that I thought about going to college. So the idea of going beyond college was way out of, beyond the pale. So when I heard that you had to do graduate work to go to psychology, that was the end of psychology. So then I needed another major, and I became very desperate because I am very non-domestic oriented as far as domestic work in the home is concerned, never had any ability at it. And I was so desperate that I was thinking of taking meat cutting. Mm. There was a course called meat cutting in the home ec school.
Oh my goodness.
And I was just didn't know what to do. And then I learned that the Graduate School of Business and Public Administration was a two-year program at Cornell, but that a senior could take the first year of the two-year program as their final year of college.
Right.
And that's what I did. I took my final year in the Graduate School of Business and Public Administration, mm-hmm. and I was first and second in those two semesters.
Good for you.
And then I graduated with a bachelor's.
Right. Now, did you march in commencement at Cornell? Do you remember?
I have no recollection of it, but I was certainly here for commencement, and I have pictures of my parents with me in, they are wearing the, I guess my father is wearing your commencement outfit.
Oh my goodness.
So I don't remember marching, but I was certainly here for commencement.
Right. Now tell me how you got to and from Cornell. You grew up in Monticello, New York. How did you get back and forth?
Well, when I first came here to start, my parents drove me up here. And after that, I don't know if you talked about the time I hitchhiked back, but other than that hitchhiking back, I don't really know how I got back and forth. But after I was here a number of months, I was very homesick. And I had a roommate named Eleanor Stevens. This would have been my second or third, would have had to be my second or third year because Eleanor didn't become my roommate until my second year. So anyway, somewhere along the line, I wanted to go back to Monticello. My parents were in Miami Beach for the winter. So I said to Stevie, suggested that we hitchhike to Monticello and I would visit my friends, and we would hitchhike back. And she agreed. And I have pictures of the two of us in our, and we had blazers and skirts. And so two men picked us up, and they were coming from visiting their sons at Cornell, and they were driving to New York City. So we told them we're on our way to Monticello. And so one of the men didn't say anything, but one of the men said, "Girls, why do you want to go to the hip town Monticello? Come with us. We'll take you to New York, and we'll take you to Radio City." So I got very worried because I thought, what would I do if those men don't drop me off at Monticello? And I was thinking what to do, but there was no problem. He kept talking along those lines, but we said, no, we want to go to Monticello. And he opened the door, dropped us off. There was no problem. In those days, I used to hitchhike a lot around Monticello, and it was a perfectly acceptable thing for a young woman to do. It was not a dangerous or risky thing. I've been conservative all my life, except when it comes to women's rights. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't doing anything risky. So we got out. We visited my high school buddy, Doris Smukler. And the next day, she took us to some place for us to hitchhike back. And we were hitchhiking back when a little truck stopped. And I saw that Stevie ran right ahead to get in the truck. So I didn't want to go because as a child, I was allergic to chicken feathers.
Mm.
And I saw that those containers in the back were containers for chickens.
Mm.
And I tried to stop her, but she was already in the little truck, so I got in. And the man driving that truck was a man, I don't know, maybe 60. His name was Sam Kaplan. And he was an egg dealer from Cortland. And as we drove, he told us stories about every house that we passed.
Oh, my goodness.
And in the beginning, I thought he was telling us the truth. And then I realized that he was making it up. he told us that he sold eggs, and every house we passed, he said, I sold eggs to this person, I sold to that, to those. So I realized he was making it up, I said, did you know General Pershing, Sam? Yes, he said he knew Pershing. So then his home was in Cortland, and he said he had lost his wife shortly before, and he was very lonesome for his wife, and would we go up and see his apartment, or his house, wherever he lived, and then he would drive us back to Cornell. So we went. He showed us his house. I don't remember. It's in my book. Mm-hmm. Whether he gave us a meal, I think we just saw his house. Mm-hmm. And we went back in the car, and he drove us to Cornell. Mm-hmm. And so let's say we were sophomores then. For as long as I was at Cornell, we called him periodically. And we'd say, hello, girls, how are you?
Oh, my goodness.
And we would talk to him and how he was doing and that kind of thing.
That's so
and
nice.
I have a story in my book called Sam Kaplan that's about him.
Okay. With your book. Now, how has Cornell influenced your life post-Cornell? Have you had some things that you can look back on and say there was an imprint left upon you or there were connections made that just have become a part of who you are that are indelible or left an indelible mark?
Well, the big effect that Cornell had on me was that before I came to Cornell, I lived with my parents in Monticello, New York, and they were from Europe, and they lived a life where the friends they had were all Jewish. Mm-hmm. The non-Jewish people, they would know they did business with them or that kind of thing, but their friends were all Jewish. And so I lived that kind of life, and also the society was that way, because I graduated first in my high school class. Second was a young woman named Marilyn Layton. Mm-hmm. She was the only person that went from my high school class to Cornell.
Oh.
We were both at Cornell, but we knew each other. We were never close in high school.
Right.
We were never close in Cornell. Something like 30 years after I graduated from Cornell, I saw her name in the alumni news.
Mm-hmm.
And she was then living, or she's now living in Beacon, New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I was living in Stamford, Connecticut, not so far from here. So I wrote her a letter. And she answered, and we met.
Hmm.
And I know I don't hear much from her now, but we became immediately very close friends.
Mm-hmm.
And we loved each other, and we talked about the fact that we had not become close friends before because she was not Jewish and I was.
Right.
And in that society, in those days, non-Jewish people and Jewish people did not become close friends.
Right.
And so that was my life until I came to Cornell. And then I was living at Balch, and at Balch, I decided to have a roommate the following year. And there was one student at Balch, her name was Barbara Joyce Carter, and she was half Jewish. So when I decided I was going to have a roommate the next year, I asked her to be my roommate because she was half Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
Then as the year progressed, I became very friendly with a woman named Flo Maragakis, who was Greek from Story in New York, and later on became friendly with this Eleanor Stevens. Both of them were not Jewish, and somewhere along the line I said, why am I rooming with Barbara Joyce Carter when I'm friendly with Flo Maragakis?
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Barbara Joyce and I said, we're really not good friends. We shouldn't be rooming together. And I roomed with Flo Maragakis and then I roomed with Eleanor Stevens. But I started to, Cornell opened up my eyes to the non-Jewish world, which is most of the world, because Jews are only 2% of the United States population. It opened my eyes up to a whole world of people that I could get to know and to like and be friends with, and I wasn't just limited to Jewish people. Mm-hmm. That is the biggest effect Cornell had on my life. Mm-hmm. And I've lived a life since then, which is an open life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And in terms of your professional connections, given your work around women's rights and women's issues for so many years, I know you had some contact with two very special people here on campus. One is, of course, Alf Cook, and the other is Jenny Farley. I'd love to hear you talk a bit about either or both of them.
Yeah, well, my connection with Alice Cook was very, very minimal. I had a friend in Washington, D.C., Sarah Gottbaum, who had parties often. And at one party, Alice Cook was there, and we chatted. And after that, we had an exchange of email, but it was very, mm-hmm. very limited. Jenny Farley, I found out about as follows. My publisher of my memoir, Ex Libris, used to publish how many books of mine were sold every month, or I think even every day, they used to do, not anymore, once a month, and they would show who bought my book and how many copies. And so I happened to notice one time that the Cornell bookstore bought 50 copies of my memoir, and then I think I saw a second time that mm-hmm. they bought another 50. So I called them up, and I said, I'm interested to see that you bought 50 copies of my memoir, or again 50. Why are you buying so many copies of my book? And they said, don't you know that your book is required reading in Jenny Farley's class? I said, I had no idea. So then I called Jenny Farley. Mm-hmm. I said, hello, my name is Sonia Fuentes, and the Cornell bookstore told me that my book is required reading in your class, and I just thought I'd call and say hello. And she immediately asked me if I could come and address that class. Mm-hmm. It was for April 2000. And if I could also address another class. One class was called something like Women and Minorities in America, and another one was a writing class. Mm. And for one of those classes, she was using my book as required reading.
Wow.
And then she also, and I asked her, in the class that was using my book, I said, well, what should I speak about? They already know about my life, they've read my book. And she gave me the idea to write a speech, which was a brand new speech, about how being an immigrant affected my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I told her that I had had ideas about that all my life, but had never put them together. And usually, if I'm writing a speech on women's rights, I take a little bit from a past speech, a little here, there, mm-hmm. put together. But this was a brand new mm-hmm. speech. And the way I wrote it was, I first wrote down every idea I'd ever had about being an immigrant. And then I just built it up,
mm-hmm.
and I gave that speech at Cornell, and I've given it many, many times since then, and written about it. And
nice. That's wonderful. In terms of your thinking about what's changed at Cornell from your experience, are there things just that have struck you? You've been back on campus several times over the past 5 or 10 years as a visitor to lecture or to take classes through Cornell Adult University. What's changed and what's the same?
Well, one thing that's, Walsh is still there.
Yeah.
I love that building.
Yes.
And that dormitory. And I'm happy that it's still there. As I mentioned to you, when I was here April 2000, I walked around the campus and I met a young woman. First I met her, she was working at the desk at Walsh.
Mm-hmm.
And then I walked around, and she was walking around, and I mentioned to her, she worked there, and I mentioned to her that on Saturday nights, Miss Armour and everybody who lived there used to have dinner in the dining room, and on Saturday night it was by candlelight, and we would sing the Cornell songs. She could not get over such a thing. She said, there's nothing like that now, and she couldn't get over it. And then you told me that, somebody told me when I arrived, it might have been you, that they don't even have a dining room at Balch anymore.
That's right.
That the people eat
in different
places. I guess the other thing I've noticed is how many foreign students there are.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there were that many foreign students when mm-hmm. I went. And I guess my other feeling was that if I could go again, whenever I go to a college campus, I wanted to matriculate. That's how I went to law school.
Really?
Yeah, I was living in Miami Beach, and I was driving by the University of Miami, a lovely campus. And I said to myself, oh, I would love to go here. And then I said to myself, I already graduated from college. And then I said, yes, but I didn't go to law school. So that was one of the reasons I went to law school. I loved college and campuses and stuff. What I would like to do is, and not seriously, is go back to Cornell as the person I am today and go for 4 years, and I would really have a wonderful time.
What would be different for you?
I would be very active in organizations.
You would? What kind of organizations?
Oh, I don't know. Whatever would strike my fancy. I'd certainly join Hillel and other organizations that would interest me.
Right.
I did not do much of that in those days. I really studied and got good grades. But I wasn't very active organization-wise, and I would love, now I am in Sarasota.
Right. Sure.
I just have a lot more fun, I think.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for your time, Sonia. This has been wonderful, and I know that others will enjoy listening to your memoirs and listening to this conversation, so thank you.
My pleasure.
All right.